Good evening, welcome to Behind the News for September 8, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. I've got two segments up for tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll speak with Dan Lazar, a journalist who is no friend of the American constitutional order, about the Roberts nomination and some reactions, I think, to the fragmentation of responsibility in the American public sphere, as exposed by Hurricane Katrina. And then at the bottom of the hour, interview recorded a couple of days ago with Barbara Ehrenreich, talking about her new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, about her foray into the world of looking for white-collar work, follow-up to her great best-selling book, Nickel and Dimed, about low-wage work in America. This time she's moving a little bit up the socioeconomic ladder and looking at the trials and tribulations of the white-collar unemployed, or those who fear they will be imminently unemployed. And a few words on the economic headlines. First, usual pair of monthly surveys of purchasing managers, the Institute for Supply Management, purchasing managers being the people who buy things for corporations and presumably know what the state of their business is, widely regarded indexes of what's happening in the general overall health of the private sector. The survey of the service side of the economy was at 53.6 in August. Any number above 50 signifies an expanding service sector, but that's down 3 points from July's reading. So it's been drifting lower since over the last year or so. It was close to 60 last September, now approaching 50, although it's got a ways to go. The employment index weakened a point, still positive, but not strongly so. The manufacturing side, according to the Institute for Supply Management, rising sharply, to everyone's surprise. Sorry, I've got that backwards. I was just reading the manufacturing side. Now let's talk about the service side. How embarrassing. This manufacturing sector has been slowing. The service sector, however, anything but. It reporting a gain to 65 from July's 60.5. Very strong reading. And the employment side of that also up strongly. 59.6, up 3 points from the previous reading. The service sector of the U.S. Showing considerable strength, according to this measure. Other measures of the economy looking a little wobbly, more wobbly. Weekly tally of jobless claims, that is the share, the number of people who have lost their jobs and heading over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits. That was off by 1,000 last week, but this is, I think, highly distorted by the hurricanes. It's quite possible that people were unable to get to the unemployment insurance office in the South, and it's almost certain to rise sharply in the coming weeks, most analysts expecting it to rise by 80,000 or more, now around 319,000, but expected to rise over 400 in the coming weeks. This 319 reading, good. Not splendid, but good. But it has been trending a little bit higher over the last several weeks. So some sign of softening in the labor market. Last Friday, we saw the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics release the monthly employment report for the month of August. The headline gain, 169,000 jobs. Less than I was expecting, not a great number, like a B minus if you had to give it a grade. But the two previous months' readings were revised upwards by a total of 44,000. So it's good but not great, somewhere between a B and a B minus. But the strong sectors were construction, reflecting the housing boom, healthcare, reflecting the continuing crisis of For some people, the healthcare crisis is good news because it means more jobs. But for most of us, it means more expensive health insurance or none at all. So that's strange to have as a very strong sector. It's not good news for most of us, although it is good news for some of us. Also showing strength, accommodations and food services. These together, construction, healthcare, and accommodations and food services, that is bars and restaurants and hotels, basically, leading the way, almost half of the month's gain. Manufacturing lost 14,000 jobs. That has been wobbling considerably, at least employment in that sector, even though production has been doing okay. Employment has not been doing okay at all. Anyway, it was a solid employment report, but again, not great. So this continues to be a very strange expansion in that the headline numbers are looking fairly good, but the job market is looking not quite so good. This morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics revised its reading on second quarter productivity, and the news here is that it showed that unit labor costs, what is the cost to employers of production, rising, a surprising 2.5% in the quarter. This is usually considered to be a leading index of inflation. So if you put that together with the high energy prices, a likely increase in grain prices as a result of clogging up the Port of New Orleans, then we're seeing inflation. And sure enough, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, Michael Moscow, was out yesterday saying that he's concerned about inflation rising. He also thinks that the economic fallout of Hurricane Katrina will be not all that severe. So it looks like, as far as the Fed and other policymakers are concerned, the human tragedy of Hurricane Katrina is not an economic tragedy. The Congressional Budget Office yesterday saying significant but not overwhelming. So the consensus, at least among those policymakers, seems to be that Katrina, too bad, but let's move on. And some disturbing polls have come out in the last couple of days. First of all, the ABC News Washington Post did a poll just after, I think it was taken last Friday and released on Monday, showing a remarkable lack of criticism of Bush and the administration's response to Hurricane Katrina. Yesterday, Gallup releasing a poll with similar findings, taken a couple of days later, early this week, despite what I have to say has been fairly good coverage in the media. We can't blame the media for this one, folks. This is the American public, and it's something close to half of the American public, and it's hardcore of invincible ignorance. But the headline in the Gallup release says, "No apparent outrage with government's response to hurricane." And I'm reading now from their release on this. "Despite widespread criticism of the response by Bush and by the federal government to the problems caused by the hurricane, the public seems on balance only mildly critical. 42% say Bush did a bad or terrible job, and 35% rate his response as either great or good. 10% of those polled rated Bush's response as great." I have to wonder what planet these people have been living on. Pew Foundation, however, coming up with a Pew Research Center for people in the press, coming up with a slightly more reassuring poll showing 28% saying Bush did all he could. 67% he could have done more. His approval rating now on the Pew measured down to 40%, down from 50% in January. Disapprove now 52%. So that is a -8 gap, approve, disapprove. Not very good numbers for Bush. Anything 40 or below is considered by polling pundits to be a presidency in trouble. So Bush is there or very close to it. I also find an enormous racial gap in perceptions. Government response, if most victims had been white, would have been faster, say 17% of whites, would have been faster, say 66% of blacks. Does the response to the hurricane show that racial inequality is still a major problem? Yes, 32% of whites, 71% of blacks. So that seems like a lot of white Americans are living in a different universe from me. And then finally, today's Washington Post reports that Joe Albaugh, former head of FEMA, is on the job in disaster relief. trying to get some work for his lobbyist clients. So he's, as he put it, just trying to lend my shoulder to the wheel, trying to coordinate some private sector support that government always asks for. He's hard at work trying to get some contracts for his clients. And that's the American way. And let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Dan Lazar. And that an excerpt from an old song by the Bobby Fuller Four, covered by many, many people, from The Clash, The Dead Kennedys, to God knows how many others. I got a collection of about a dozen of them, I think. The original, though. And that was my best attempt at finding a Supreme Court-themed song to introduce this segment. I've got Dan Lazar, author of several books, including The Frozen Republic from several years ago, The Velvet Coup, I'm citing those because they're about law and our constitutional system. And I have been bored to death reading about the Supreme Court in recent weeks, and I thought that Dan was someone to bring into the show to talk about why this obsessive focus on the Supreme Court might be a little misplaced. Welcome to WBAI, Dan.
Hey, Doug.
First of all, since you've written a lot on the dysfunctional nature of American government, any observations on the response to Hurricane Katrina to start with?
It just gets worse and worse. It's amazing. When I wrote The Frozen Republic in 96, I tried really hard not to sound like Chicken Little and saying the sky was fallen. So I adopted a very moderate, very measured and careful tone. Well, in hindsight, I wish I hadn't been so moderate. I mean, the sky really is falling. It's incredible. The amazing decrepitude of American governing institutions was really revealed in that incident. It was like the Three Stooges. It was like, no one knew. You know, everyone was in the dark. There were no preparations. There was failure up and down the line, 20, 30 years of failure. There were the levees in New Orleans were managed by something like a dozen different local agencies. There were no controls over development of the floodplain, which made this whole thing much worse. The rescue effort, as you know, was just completely botched. It's just astonishing that the breakdown in American government just seems to be accelerating.
But at least judging from some of those polls, the American public doesn't seem to be too outraged.
American politics is decaying, and one aspect of that is a lowering of the political intelligence. I mean, the American voters are increasingly detached, increasingly unthoughtful, sort of guided by instinct or complacent or just focused elsewhere. It wasn't always the case in America. There was a book written in the 1830s by an English woman who traveled through Ohio, and she quoted one local man as saying, "I'd rather have my son be a drunkard than not pay attention to the affairs of the republic."
What 19th century visitors frequently remarked on how ordinary Americans were constantly talking about politics, constantly debating, now it's just a big shrug here in the early 21st century.
Yeah, well, a century of consumer capitalism seems to have really dulled the political instinct, and Americans are really just focused on other matters like their mortgages and buying into the housing market and taking out equity loans
and Paris Hilton's imminent wedding. I'm working myself on a proposal for a little book on the decay of the American ruling class. But I've been struck that our elite is almost guilty of the same things that the masses are usually accused of: a level of detachment, and self-involvement, an inability to think beyond the next week. It's remarkable.
Like, just like, you know, a level of nihilism. It's amazing. Wherever this ruling class goes, they spread destruction and disorder. I mean, Iraq has been, you know, has been just destroyed. I mean, Haiti. I mean, these people can't even do a good old-fashioned colonial takeover. I mean, they just leave in their wake a swath of destruction and disorder. As this country just seems to be really, I don't know, it's really amazing to describe.
Yes, words fail one to describe.
Truly.
Well, let's turn a little bit to the Supreme Court. There's acres and acres of coverage of the Supreme Court, the Roberts nomination. Liberals, if we look at the sort of the left side of the political spectrum, liberals are obsessed with the Supreme Court. Is all this obsession justified?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, the Supreme Court has emerged from the least important of the three branches to the most important of the three branches. I mean, all the other branches, especially Congress, have been happy to shunt off responsibility under the backs of the courts. This has been a process that's been going on for 50 years now.
What do you mean by that?
Well, starting in the 1940s, I mean, Congress was happy to duck the important issues, such as race, for example, and leave it to the Supreme Court to decide. And both liberals and conservatives collaborated in this ducking of responsibility. And of course, when the Supreme Court did decide, and, you know, in Brown v. Board of Ed in 1954, liberals were ecstatic and were convinced that their strategy had paid off, because they had created this kind of new liberal court, or this new liberal court had been created since 1937, and it was a powerful new instrument for social reform. So they were happy to have, you know, Congress marginalized, and this the Supreme Court then take the lead.
Well, let's go back into the 30s, though. When Roosevelt was unhappy with the court, he tried to pack it with a whole bunch of new members who would be friendly to him. So what happened to the liberals who then made friends with the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, Roosevelt lost the battle and won the war. The court packing proposal was beaten back, but the in what I think was Abe Fortas labeled the what was it, the Oh, I forgot. I'm sorry. Anyways, the court did an about face and suddenly approved all the New Deal legislative proposals that they had previously overturned.
And well, there's an old cliche: the Supreme Court reads the election returns.
Right. Right.
Who said that? Where did that come from?
That, I think, was a famous columnist in the early part of the 20th century. But the idea is, yes, the court is supposedly above politics, but nothing is really ever above politics. So the court is certainly aware of what's happening outside its chambers. But the 1937 started the court on a great trek to the liberal side of the spectrum, but that has essentially stopped since the 1970s. Roe v. Wade in 73 probably marked the high watermark. And the conservatives have mounted a great counteroffensive, and have succeeded in pushing the court farther and farther to the right, and transforming it, returning it to its traditional role as a guardian of conservative constitutional virtues in this country. And certainly, the Roberts nomination is part of that trend. Bush wants to, you know, even if Bush is ridden out of town on a rail, he wants to leave, you know, govern from the grave by leaving his imprint on the court.
Or government from his ranch,
his
retirement. Well, let's go back into history. How the court emerge coming out of the Constitution in its early years? How did the Supreme Court emerge into this extraordinarily powerful role as an arbiter of whether laws were proper or not?
Well, you have a document, you have a Constitution, which is almost impossible to change. So consequently, everything an interpretation becomes all important, and the court, even no matter how reluctant it's been at various points, has been essentially forced to serve as interpreter in chief, and this is a very powerful position, And we see at key points the court has stepped in and interpreted the Constitution in various ways, and which has just really altered the course of American political development. You know, there's some of the rulings on states' rights, on contract law in the early 19th century, certainly on slavery in the 1850s, which led directly to the Civil War. And then, you know, of course, in the post-Civil War period, a series of rulings that were increasingly favorable to large corporations, which facilitated the explosive growth of American corporate capitalism.
And, of course, there's always this ridiculous fetish of trying to figure out what the framers meant. But what was the intention of the Supreme Court? Was it intended as some kind of check on democracy or what?
It was originally considered to be the least important of the three. It was going to be sort of the umpire, and everyone assumed that Congress would be the most important of the three. Congress would sort of serve as a quasi-parliamentary body, and Congress would set policy, which the president would then carry out, and the Supreme Court would occasionally step in to adjudicate disputes. But obviously, the courts as Congress has withered and as politics have withered. The court has played an increasingly, you know, dominant role until now. It has now gone from the least important, the least among equals, to the greatest among equals.
And what do you make of Roberts himself?
Well, Roberts is, I mean, he's clearly bad. I mean, he seems to be bad, but of course this whole process is so enigmatic that you never really can be quite sure. Everyone has the David Souter example in mind, where Souter seemed to be a conservative Republican, and now has blossomed into what seems to be a somewhat liberal member of the Supreme Court. So
it's very weird. You appoint these guys, you don't really understand exactly what they're all about, and then they're around for 30 years.
Well, it's an example of how the system really dissolves accountability. There really is no accountability, and there really is no responsibility. People, you know, senators will go and vote for this guy, and they'll have the perfect excuse. They really have no idea who they're voting for.
There's this presumption the president deserves the person that he nominates.
There's a presumption that the president's favor.
Unless you're got some raving scandal in a skeleton in his closet.
But. Right, which is why they always play the game of trying to find the scandal. The presumption is
but
always
pretend, we're pretending favor. It's not a political appointment. So.
Right, supposedly the law is above politics. And to a strange way, it is above politics in this country, which is why we've seen the incredible expansion of the legal realm and the shrinkage of the political realm, and shrinkage both, you know, quantitatively and qualitatively, where, you know, our political intelligence is just plummeting. You have this amazingly nihilistic ruling class and a population at large, which a large portion of which is simply just turned off and hopelessly inert.
But the Supreme Court is still one of the most respected institutions of our society.
Yeah.
Which says something about our society,
I guess.
But well, one of my beefs with the court is that there's this whole litigious or legalistic approach that a lot of liberals pursue these days, which is that, you know, it's all about filing lawsuits. There's no organization. There's no ideological agitation. You look at the pro-choice movement. It really has done almost no kind of political organizing. We depend on the court to protect our civil liberties.
That's quite true. I mean, liberals were in a very bad spot in the 40s and 50s. The Congress was dominated by these hidebound reactionaries and Southern Dixiecrats. You know, really controlled all the major committees, and so that avenue seemed to be totally blocked as an avenue for reform. So the liberals, you know, turned to the courts. But clearly, in hindsight, over the long haul, they ended up making a pact with the devil, because as they turned to the courts, they became increasingly litigious, cut off from any democratic base, and politics came to be articulated in this highly arcane academic discourse of constitutional law. And meanwhile, the average person was sort of left off, and was marginalized, and was often very resentful over his or her marginalization. So consequently, a basis was created for a kind of a mass resistance, the famous silent majority of the Nixon years.
But then, you know, this kind of takes us back to where we started, which is this immense detachment of the American public from politics is no accident, as the vulgar Marxists used to say. It's a whole process of structural decisions that have brought it about.
Well, I think first of all, the theory behind the Constitution itself is a theory of that the people are a mob, therefore the people must be controlled by a body of unalterable law. Number one, but number two is that this system has become increasingly sclerotic over the years. That process has gone farther and farther. So the people are more and more marginalized. There are profoundly undemocratic features of the U.S. Constitution, which the people are simply powerless to change due to an abstract body of law, which says that people can't affect it. The Second Amendment, the question of equal state representation in the Senate, which is just...
The Senate literally cannot be abolished under American constitutional right now.
It can't be reformed. It can't be... The principle of equal state representation is literally unchangeable. It would require the unanimous approval of all 50 states to change.
Which would never happen.
Which would never happen. So therefore, consequently, you have a lily-white Wyoming has the same number of senators, the same number of votes as a California, which is what the first minority-majority state, where whites are actually a minority. This exists nowhere else in the world. There's nowhere – I mean, no other legislative body is this inequitable, this undemocratic. And
but that was the design of the Senate, wasn't it?
It was, but the inequities were much less in 1790 than they are today.
But wasn't it what's that phrase of Jefferson's? It was a saucer meant to cool the hot tea? Or?
That was actually Washington's phrase. That was the idea. The idea is that the people are a mob. They're passionate. They're unthinking. So therefore, we must surround them with all kinds of legal hedges to rein them in. This is a very undemocratic concept, but the idea is, you know, so we have the Senate, we have this profoundly undemocratic, profoundly racist millionaires club we call the U.S. Senate, which the people made in the people's name, but which the people are unable to reform. They're prevented by law from reforming. Second Amendment is the same thing. The Electoral College is the same thing. It's all this increasingly sclerotic, paralyzing structure.
But of course, we take the Constitution as a sacred document.
Yeah, whatever happens, and I assume that Roberts will be confirmed. But even if he was stopped, I mean, this process of decay is going to accelerate. That is I'm absolutely sure of that. We'll see one too many New Orleanses.
We've only got like a minute left, but if Roberts is confirmed, it's very likely we'll have a 30-year conservative majority in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
What do we do about this? Anything?
What do we do about it? What we've got to do is we've got to develop a truly radical left-wing and truly democratic movement, which cuts its ties to this completely reactionary Jeffersonianism, which is, you know, sort of defines American, you know, reform movements to date, you know, and heads off in bold new directions. I mean, this country is sinking really fast. I think I'm not being an alarmist here, and I think that America is in deep trouble, and it's up to the people to save it, to transform it, to reform it, and that's it.
Well, to quote our president, out of the rubbles of Trent Lott's house will emerge a great new structure, and he's
right.
Looking forward to sitting on the porch. So maybe out of the rubbles of our Constitution, we can come up with something better than Trent Lott's house, I hope. Thanks, Dan Lazar. I've been speaking with Dan Lazar, who is a journalist and working on a book about religion now, right?
Yes, yes.
Does it have a title?
Not yet.
Okay, but you're going to make even more friends with that when that comes out. Right? All right, Dan Lazar, author from 1996 of the book The Frozen Republic and The Velvet Coup about the 2000 decision that made George Bush our president.
Which, by the way, Roberts took part in that incident. He traveled to Florida to consult with Jeb Bush.
It lingers on. Thanks for joining us, Dan. Let's take a little break, and I'll be back to introduce Barbara Ehrenreich.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
I love Al Lewis live. Saturdays at noon. Oh, yeah.
I'm Karen Lewis. I love my co-producer, Grandpa Al Lewis, together with
engineer Eliza Butler and you, the listeners.
We talk about politics, community, and social justice. Things you can get passionate about. Al Lewis Live.
Saturdays, noon to 1:30 p.m.
Get passionate about something. Oh, yeah.
And we're back. This is Doug Ken with the show Behind the News. And next guest is an interviewer recorded a couple of days ago with Barbara Ehrenreich. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of many books, I think about a dozen so far. She's the author of the smash bestseller Nickel and Dimed, about her experience taking on a series of low-wage jobs, illustrating to those Americans who did not already know it that the working poor in this country have a really, really tough time of it. And now she is taking on the world of white-collar office work and attempting to get a job and seeing what that's like with less success than she did getting low-wage jobs, for sure. The book is called Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Okay, here we go. Barbara Ehrenreich.
So after having inhabited a set of low-wage jobs, you've moved up the social ladder a bit and tried to get a job in corporate America. Tell us about, first of all, the kind of career coaches you first approached to launch your new career.
Well, yes. The idea was that I wanted to understand something about downward mobility, really, because since writing Nickel and Dimed, I get a lot of letters from people in tough situations, and I was surprised at how many of these people identified themselves as having college degrees and master's degrees in some cases, and having once had white-collar corporate jobs. So I thought, what's going on here? This is, you know, an aspect of poverty I had not thought about, and decided to, well, I'll get a corporate white-collar job myself, which I thought would take about 4 or 5 months. And in the meantime, of course, I would be learning about how hard it is to get a job or how easy or whatever. And I had to, you know, one of my starting resolves was that I would take any kind of advice and help I could get. You know, I would look for guidance. And, you know, fortunately or not, I don't know which to say, there is a lot of help these days for a price, because since the mid-90s, this whole so-called transition industry has grown up around white-collar unemployment. Career coaches are a very large part of it. So I had, I had several of them, or encountered them in one way or another. They will tweak your resume, help pump up your resume, pump up your attitude. They all want to test your personality. An interesting thought right there, because I couldn't see what that had to do with anything.
Is this to lend it some sort of scientific credibility, or is this to prepare you for what the corporate headhunters are looking for, or what?
It's a mystery. You know, Doug, I always think of the corporate world as something, you know, very rational, must be right. It's all, they have to focus on the numbers, on the bottom line. And yet that's not what I found. Most major corporations administer these personality tests, which have been completely discredited. I should mention an excellent book that came out a few months ago called Cult of Personality by a woman named Annie Murphy Paul. She just, you know, just shows how the major tests that are used are useless, have no predictive value, no scientific basis. And yet everybody in the corporate world seems to believe in these things. Now, I took one test, the Enneagram test, which is a really dodgy kind of new age thing derived.
Sounds like Scientology.
Well, it's derived from, or so the websites tell me, from ancient Sufi wisdom, from ancient Celtic lore. You know, it's just a new age hodgepodge. I found it almost incomprehensible for bad, you know, I just couldn't even understand the questions. In part because the wording is so poor or ambiguous, like, you know, agree or disagree, to describe yourself. I am, quote, wow, W-O-W. What does that mean?
Well,
am I wow? Tell me.
I think so.
But, thank you. But, you know, what does that mean? Anyway, in that test, my coach told me that my personality was good and loving, also melancholy and envious, and that the bottom line from all that was somehow that I was not probably somebody who should be a writer.
Well, boy, that's some good test. Then you have been a writer for many years, so how did you, we're all supposed to brand ourselves, as Tom Peters taught us, how did you brand yourself or package yourself what would have been a really major change in your career path?
Well, I presented myself as a PR person, because that's something I actually could do. A lot of people in PR come from journalism. You know, it's a writing. It depends on writing and verbal communication. And I thought, this is something I can do. So I didn't want to put anything in my fake resume that I could not actually, in good conscience, do. And I'm sure I could have been a crackerjack PR person, as my one of my coaches urged me to put it. So that was what I was. I had a different name, too, because I was a little afraid that my real name, Barbara Ehrenreich, would turn up a little too many Google entries if anybody looked. So I had a different name.
How did you begin your job search?
Well, with I drafted a rough draft of a resume. First I had the career coach who, you know, I just told you about, who told me I couldn't be a writer. Then I went to some other career coaches. I had more personality tests, a lot more resume tweaking, and then I let myself loose into the world of so-called networking, you know, getting out there in public, meeting people who mainly turned out to be other, you know, job seekers. There is, and you probably are aware of this, Doug, there's a tremendous amount of churning going on in the corporate world. People, whether it's large layoffs, like the ones that have just recently been announced by Hewlett-Packard and Kimberly-Clark and other places, or individual firings and some kind of cost-cutting measure that someone has decided to institute, reorganizations, outsourcings. So there's this constant, you know, churning of people out of the corporate world who then try to get back in or, you know, find some other line of work. And that's the kind of people I was with.
I'm speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, author most recently of Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. What kind of people, you know, did you meet in the course of this networking, in the course of this job search? Presumably they were not in this in a research project, but to find a job. So,
I don't think any of them were undercover.
What can you say about the kinds of folks
mostly
that you met?
Mostly middle-aged, white people who were in things like marketing and IT, or information technology, some management, quite discouraged people. I think, you know, it's well known from lots of studies that depression is rife among the people who've experienced job loss. The job loss is somewhere up there with divorce or a major illness as a great shock in people's lives.
Had most of these people lost jobs, or are they just looking for others?
That was interesting. I was surprised at how many people you run into who are employed but are unhappy or scared for one of two reasons. One could be that they're way overworked. They just cannot take the 14-hour days or whatever is expected from them. And that kind of overwork is endemic in corporations now because they have, you know, this downsizing trend since the early 90s, really, has left the survivors in corporations often doing the work of two people.
That's productivity for you.
That's productivity. Yeah, you please the shareholders by downsizing, cutting to the bone, and then you have people who really can't live that way. I don't know who could, but people do. And the second category of employed people you find in all these networking groups and boot camps and so on for job seekers, are people who are working but hear the drumbeats of layoffs. Some, you know, rumors have started, they're seeing other people laid off, and they're scared.
So I've heard a lot about networking, but how do you do it? What does it mean?
Maybe I should charge you if I'm going to coach you in this. Everybody else charges in this business. The idea is simply that what gets you a job is not what's on your resume, what you've accomplished, things like that. It's who you know. So that you have to be out and about amongst people you can be handing business cards to and smiling at and impressing in some way. And the question is, how do you go about this? How do you find the business people to network with? I made many attempts, sometimes with, you know, just other job seekers, and now and then a recruiter will show up at these job seekers and networking events, and sometimes by going to actual business gatherings to, you know, kind of insert myself and pass out my business card.
And were the folks mostly upbeat? Did you get any chance to hear them reflect on their situation, their psychology or politics or anything like that? Or is it all just
the laid-off
ambition?
People?
Yeah.
Well, there is great pressure that you encounter throughout this transition industry with career coaches, the advice books, the networking events. The pressure is to never express any anger or resentment, you know, about the loss of your last job, about anything like that, about the fact that you might have to sell your house, or whatever disasters you're facing. You have to always look upbeat and be cheerful and positive, because your attitude actually is the major thing that controls your destiny, whether you'll get another job, why you lost the last one. So the pressure, the ideological pressure, once you enter this nether world of the white-collar unemployed, is, you know, to just fixate on yourself. It was must be your fault if you lost that last job. Don't analyze. I mean, all of this is really nicely laid out in the book Who Moved My Cheese, which I just read quite recently, you know, that when the cheese gets moved. You've read the book, haven't you?
No, I've heard it described to me, though.
Okay. Well, when the cheese is moved, the little tiny people waste valuable time, quote, ranting and raving about the injustice of it all, end quote. Bad move. You know, when the cheeses move, you just scurry away and find a new cheese source. You never question anything. You just keep smiling. And that's what you're getting, you know, this powerful pressure not to question, not to resist, not to organize.
It should be pointed out this book has spent something like 200 weeks in the bestseller list, right? And Tom Frank says he talked to workers who had to, as part of their job, sit in circles and read passages of it aloud.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a heavy, heavy propagandizing of the corporate class.
No, that's I've heard the same thing, that of being bought up in bulk and distributed to middle-level workers. But you can see the ideological intent. Now, when you get people alone, some people will speak quite frankly and bitterly about their experience, although they know better than to express that in a larger forum. So this answered one question for me, is why isn't there more protest about all this turmoil in the white-collar corporate world? Because there is this whole, you know, apparatus set up to squelch protest.
How did you go about applying for jobs? Did you list yourself, send out resumes, read the want ads? What was the process?
Oh, want ads is so 1980s. Now, you know, you post your resume on the various Internet job sites like Monster.com and Hot Jobs and so on. And, you know, I thought for me it was a kind of a thrilling moment when I thought my resume was in good enough shape to put it in all these places, including some of the more specialized PR-related websites, job sites. But then you wait, and you wait, and you wait. And that's when I began to realize that, brilliant as my resume might be, it was out there jostling for attention with millions of other resumes. Companies seldom now even bother to have a human being read resumes. They have computer programs that scan them for keywords, and, you know, who knows what those keywords are. Nothing, I would have to say, and most people I met, including some of the coaches, confirmed this, that the job boards on the Internet do not do a lot to connect people with jobs.
I'm speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, author most recently of Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. You and also I would have a problem both being north of 50. What are the prospects for someone approaching the near elderly demographic, as they say?
Well, the near elderly demographic in the corporate world seems to be anything north of 40. This is very alarming to me that, one of my coaches said, you must not have anything in your resume that betrays your age. And I said, well, you can look, you can see, you know, that I have experience that goes back to, I think I even had the late 70s. And she said, oh, take it all out. You know, you can have 10 years, 15 years max worth of experience in your resume. So, you know, you could be...
Then I wonder if you're in prison beforehand?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, you have to, because... Apparently, you know, experience is not really relished. It's not really treasured by the corporate world. They want youth. I've met people who were, like, in their early 40s saying they felt their job search was pretty hopeless at their age.
And that came with no bitterness or
sadness,
even political conscience, just regret.
Sadness and a sense of defeat, yeah.
Hmm. So there's no dawning of any kind of political consciousness among the job seekers you saw.
Well, I did speak this in the fall of 2004. Several people volunteered to me that they were not going to vote for Bush because they thought he was lying about the economy. What I would like to see happen is job seekers, blue as well as white collar, coming together and in ways that support each other, helping, you know, sharing stories, for example, is a psychological help. And beginning to figure out how to lobby for things that would make their lives more bearable, such as universal health insurance, such as extended unemployment benefits, such as making corporations a bit more accountable. You know, right now, some of the major corporations are cashing in on the so-called American Jobs Creation Act of 2005. That act allows them to, it's an enormous tax break, allows them to repatriate funds they've had in other parts of the world with the idea that they'll bring it back and create more American jobs, because that's what the bill is called. Well, one of the companies taking advantage of this is Hewlett-Packard, which will save billions and billions due to this tax break. And it has just announced that it's laying off 14,500 people. Now, it seems to me, without being too, you know, threatening to corporate power or anything, the government ought to be able to say, we're not giving you all these subsidies and tax breaks in the name of jobs creation if you're destroying jobs at the same time.
The profits are for shareholders, not workers, of course. So did you end up getting a job out of all this effort?
Yes. I had an offer. Whether you'd call it a job was another thing. I finally got in my inbox an email saying, we really like your resume. You know, we think you've got a bright future here with us at Aflac, the supplemental health insurance company. And so I had my first real interview. In fact, I had two of them. Strange interviews because he never asked me any questions, oddly, for 2 hours. And then he offered me a job as a salesperson for Aflac, selling supplemental health insurance. And I said, I don't want to be a salesperson, but I will manage salespeople for you. I will run, you know, I will manage this region or whatever. No. I have to be a salesperson, and then I will recruit other people that I can manage, you know, one of those sort of pyramid scheme things. And though I shouldn't, you know, I'm not saying that at is exactly a pyramid scheme thing. And I said, okay, well, is there health insurance? No. All right, so you're selling health insurance, you got no health insurance. What's the pay? None. It's commission only. Do I get an office to work out of? No. So this is a job. And yet there are so many people, I give numbers in the book, I can't think of them right off the top of my head, but who, you know, end up in these, quote, jobs with absolutely no security, not that anybody has much security, but, you know, it's a real crapshoot. No benefits, nothing. You're on your own. You just sort of get a license to go out and sell their product.
Some of us who are freelancers sometimes look enviously at people with what we imagine to be stable jobs and regular paychecks and good benefits. Is that an illusion? Is that a fantasy of the grass on the other side of the hill being greener?
Well, I've certainly gotten over any feelings like that. You know, I've been a freelancer for, 25 years or something, and often thought, you know, it's just so brave of me, so noble, I have given up all that security. There's no security on the other side. I think we, who are, you know, the permanent freelancers, maybe are better suited to survive. The sad thing is that more and more people are being pushed into a kind of freelancing or consulting, as it's called genteelly in the corporate world, because nobody wants you as a regular employee anymore. I've talked to people who had a job, were cut loose during some kind of downsizing, then invited back 6 months later as a consultant. Same job, no benefits. Could be, you know, a duration of 6 weeks or something at that point.
So what's the next project? Have you exhausted the job market and you're moving on?
I've been rejected by the job market. Yeah, I think right now it's all I can do to talk about this and try to get a conversation launched among white-collar people who might never have thought of poverty as something, you know, affecting their lives, get a serious conversation launched about what to do about this extreme insecurity and turmoil in their lives.
Well, I know you're fairly early in the phases, fairly early in that process, but are you getting any kind of, is anybody picking up and starting the conversation?
Well, it's just, this, yesterday was the pub date for the book. Oh, no, it's actually next week. Is the pub date for the book. But I have a website, BarbaraEhrenreich.com, and if people visit it and leave their email addresses, we will eventually have some kinds of resources for people in this situation put up there. Right now you'll find on that website a lot of conversation still going on about nickel and dime, too.
All right, and then you're in New York next Wednesday night, right?
That's right, at Barnes & Noble on Union Square.
Okay, well, everyone should go off and see you there. All right, thanks for joining us, Barbara. Good luck.
Oh, my pleasure, Doug.
And that was Barbara Ehrenreich in an interview recorded earlier this week. Her book, again, is called Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, just out from Henry Holt. And you can see her next week on Wednesday evening, 7 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble on Union Square in Manhattan. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'm not sure if we'll be back next week because of the Roberts hearings, but let's go out with this from the appropriately named Johnny Paycheck. Not his real name. He was born Donald Little, but he changed his name in 1966. This song, Take This Job and Shove It, from 1977. A kind of song you won't see in the charts today, I don't think. Till next week or the week after. Bye.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. I've been working in this factory now 15 years. All this time I watched my woman drowning in a pool of tears. And I've seen a lot of good folk die, had a lot of bills to pay. I'd give the shirt right off of my back if I had the guts to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working.